So even if they're not normally allowed to use me as an SMTP forwarder, if they're sending messages to certain places, I'll forward them. And that's what forward to does. The cases for those are rare, but they do come up. That's why I haven't put them in the main example today. But I do want to let you know that those are in there so that you can, if one of those cases arises, those commands are there to do that. Yes?
How do you stop when you put spammers that they think about? The ones that don't have the domain name, can you do anything about those? So it's like anonymous messages that you get that are sent to 7,000 people?
Well, if you, they can't use your server to send them if you don't allow it to be forwarded. So if you say you only forward from people you know, then anyone who doesn't have a domain name can't forward through you. You can't stop them if they came from somewhere else, because their message is to all these pieces. But you can avoid being the source of them, which is really ultimately all you can do.
I guess I'm confused as how I can become the source.
Very simple. If I have forward from star, I'm going to let anybody forward through me, and I know that, I can sit here and go into Eudora, think about your Eudora configuration. I can make up any name I want. I can be anybody I want. I can send a message to anybody I want, and I can aim it at your forwarder, and it'll look like it came from you.
What's to stop you from being still at anyplace.com?
Very little.
But
I have to know to do that.
Okay.
I have to know to do that. That's correct.
I'll get you.
Bottom line is, internet email is incredibly spoofable. It's just about impossible not to make a message that looks like it came from someone else. There's just no way in the internet email structure. So don't believe email is, and caution anybody you supply email to. If a message that came from somebody doesn't look like something they would have written, they may not have written it. There is no way on earth to prevent me from writing an email message and sending it to someone that looks like it came from you. And there will be no way to prove it didn't come from you. And that's just a function of how the internet works, email. The protocols just cannot be secured.
You know, you're saying you just really, you can find somebody who's got, you know, theirs open, you can really forward your mail to anybody.
Absolutely. And by the way, 90% of all SMTP send mail sites on the internet are promiscuous forwarders.
Well, I don't know if mine, if my mail box goes down,
absolutely, and you don't even know who it is. You just found an IP address that'll forward for you, right? Because most of them will. Absolutely, and if you spend another day, you could have 200. And once you have a promiscuous forwarder, you have an entry into email system on the internet that no one can trace that it didn't come from the source that you say it came from. So literally, in email, you can't make it provable that the source is who it says it is, and you can't make it provable, you can't prevent people from being you on the internet at an email level. Can't be done unless you encrypt the text of the message with PGP or something and use signature keys in the message itself. But the structure of mailing around the internet, there's no way to secure it. Just by technology, it can't be done. Yes. The normal reason that things are promiscuous servers is it's really a lot harder in send mail to not be one.
Why would I, if I'm not trying to spoof somebody, why would I want to do that?
Let me back up and repeat what I said. The reason there are so many promiscuous forwarders out there is most of the email in the net is done with send mail. And in send mail, if you want to have a non-promiscuous forwarder, it's a much more difficult configuration task. Most people take the easy road and just turn it on. And when you just turn it on, it's a promiscuous forwarder. It's not because they wanted to be. My guess is 80% of them probably don't even know they are. And there's the rest of 20% know they are, but don't know how not to be. Or don't have the time. And I repeat, if you have never seen send mail and you have never addressed it, you cannot appreciate the amount of your time it can suck to do the simplest thing. It will do anything. conceive the most tortuous set of conditions you can imagine for email, and Sendmail will let you.
As long as you can
that's right. But when you approach it, it's unbelievably difficult and time-consuming to make it do anything, every move you make. And you have to remember that most email sites on the net use Sendmail. That's the number one thing that does email on the net. And most of what you see out there when you say, how come it's like that, ultimately boils down to because it takes too much time on somebody's part for it to be otherwise. Yeah. If you don't put the forward from in here, your customer that has a pop mailbox can receive mail, but he can't send any. Remember our diagram over here about how this works. Clients like Eudora, pop mail is a one-way thing. It's just out from the system to you. It creates this pop mail area that makes you the destination to SMTP for email for that name, and it falls into your destination. And as far as the email system and the internet's concerned, it got all the way to where it's supposed to go. It's really just sitting on your system, though, in a file. And when your caller calls in to pick it up, he goes to an entirely separate server called the POP email server, whose whole job is to give him a name and password logon and let him get to his holding area on your machine and take stuff out of it. There's no way through that system to send anything out. It's always sent with SMTP. So your customer who wants to send an email message has to send it through SMTP, and he can send it directly to the end, but then he's at the mercy of if the end isn't there, if there's a problem, if there's a delay, he has to stay logged on until that mail can be delivered. By definition, if he's using a pop mailbox, he's a transient customer and he doesn't want to be hooked up all the time. So he's using you as a forwarder saying, I know you're up all the time, you're my provider, I'm going to quick send you this message with SMTP and I'll let you send it on so that if there's any delays or any holding times, you're always there. I know you're always online, so you'll do it for me. If you don't put a forward from in, you won't accept his mail to forward and he won't be able to do that. You can always consign him to one of the promiscuous forwarders that are out there. These names right here do not have to be wildcarded. You can do them individually. And you can wildcard any amount of the front. You cannot embed wildcards. Like you couldn't put DOM question question. You can't do that. But you can wildcard any part of the front. So anything that matches this on the end matches. You can move the wild card as far back as you want. That's why you can put an at sign here that says, okay, the domain has to match exactly, but the name can be anything. Or you can put user at domain.com with no wild cards, and only that exact name will match. Yes, and you can stack these up and have any number of any of these commands that you want or need. Yes?
If you just wanted to forward this to your customers only, you can just do a wildcard your domain.com. Right?
That's correct if all your customers had your domain, but many of them will have email domains of their own. So you'll have to put a forward from on each of those domains in here, too. So, like, you know, the Joe's Garage example in DNS where you gave him an email. And you'll set him up with an MX record, so his email comes to you. You'll set him up with a pop box, so his email goes into it. And you'll set up with a forward from Joe's so that he can forward as himself. He doesn't have to be you to forward out. Yes?
Are any of these configurations
case sensitive? No. Question is, are any of these configurations case sensitive? The answer is no.
We have an MS mail system, and we're going to put a gateway in front of it.
Yes.
Mail has a real weird name requirement. You've got to put the mailbox ID and so on.
Right.
But we want to give them a standard internet email name. Like you put on your pop.
And the question, this question boils down, there's a lot of varieties of this question. It says we're getting a gateway for MS Mail, and the names in MS Mail and the addressing is real different than it is on the internet. That's the gateway software's issue. And how you do that is up to the gateway software, not up to the iPad. The iPad's dealing with it only. The gateway has to transform it into the internet structure before it deposits it in this box. It sends it as an internet message. It receives internet messages into the incoming gateway directory. Then the gateway software has some set of mapping rules that'll turn that over. So that's the gateway software that makes those rules. And quite frankly, a lot of different gateways have a lot of different rules. I mean, it's just totally up to how the gateway itself was designed.
Can you just explain briefly again, how does the gateway get the mail out of those directories?
Basically, these directories that feed gateways have to be on LAN server connected devices where the iPad and the gateway software, which run on different machines, can both see the same file directory on some server somewhere. The gateway polls the receiving directory to see messages show up. The iPad polls this directory to see them show up from the gateway to send them. There's a whole sophisticated situation of file locking and locks and stuff that is all there, and we'll explain it in a tech note to anybody who wants to write gateway software and all that stuff. The format of these files is basically based on a program called Waffle that was running around for a while. We use the same file formats in our gateway directories that Waffle used, which is basically just an RFC 822 message in a D file, and an X file, and a CMD file that map directly to the way UUCP stores these things on Unix. But that's email. And ultimately, it's really pretty simple. If you just stop and think before you start to configure, take a second to sit on a piece of paper and say, what are you trying to do? And I want a pop box isn't really what you're trying to do. That's part of what you're trying to do. Because you want a pop box, but the guy you gave a pop box to, you want to let him forward through you as well. And more to the point, if you made a domain for him and he made bozo.com, and he's got Joe at bozo.com and Fred at bozo.com, you have to say, well, what happens if I get one for Larry at bozo.com, which there's no such person as? Do I want to reject it here? Or does he want a garbage collecting pop box that I put star at bozo.com here so that anything that's addressed to anybody who's not explicitly called out all dumps into a separate pop box? You have your choice. You can do it what you do it. You do it how he wants it done. But you have to say all those things through. Think them through in words and pictures before you try to configure so that you have a good understanding of what you're trying to do. Because normally what happens in email when people get in deep, deep trouble is they start trying to configure when they don't have a clear picture in their head of all the ramifications of what they're trying to do. And this is really complicated. Even if it seems simple, like I want to make a pop box, there's 15 different considerations that come up right there already. What happens if it doesn't match to that domain? Should I reject it? Should I accept it? Should I put it in a pop box? What should I do? Yeah. Mm-hmm. No. They appear in certain places. If you only have one iPad running, these directories are all set up to allow multiple iPads to use the same directories to gang send mail and receive mail in parallel and all that sort of stuff to build up capacity. So the iPad cannot assume that other programs like a gateway or another iPad are not really there with a busy file. If you know at a moment when your system is down in a reboot condition or restart condition, you happen as a human to know with the situation that there's nothing there, you could make a pretty simple batch file to just go through and clean them out. Yeah, well, mostly if your system's down and there's still any of those files, it's because it crashed or something in the past or something happened to it. That's the only way they get there. Their presence slows it down because it keeps thinking it's supposed to do something with them. And if you pile up a whole bunch of them, they can slow it down noticeably, yes. Because they're supposed to be very transient things, and it keeps being very agitated that it knows it's supposed to do something with it. Attached files and emails, are any limit? It's a disk size limit only. Now, the thing to understand in PopMail is that in the current iPad implementation, when you open up the POP server, it reads through the PopMail file sequentially to find where all the messages are. So if you have a 12 megabyte file, it can take it, you know, a minute to read the whole file. And you have to configure your client on the receiving end to wait that long without giving up. There are settings to do that. In future versions of the iPad, we're going to index that file so that it doesn't have to do that. That's
And the big problem, I had a bad situation where I had an attached file that for some reason when it got to that file it just crapped out on me. I cleared and deleted everything and started from scratch.
There's no reason that should happen, no.
I don't think I can think of a
file got corrupted or something.
Obviously, since you've now deleted the cause, I can't even go look. I can't really do much more than speculate. But no, there is nothing normal that should cause a problem because a file is really big, except in the pop mail setting. In the pop mail setting, when files get really, really big, it can take a while. It'll say pop mail logging on for a long time, and you have to set your client to wait that long.
Well, this wasn't a big file. It was very small.
Yeah, no, I can't really answer. Something's corrupted.
I may actually still have the file if I do all that you guys know.
I'd like to see it if you do, because it might have exposed some bug in a mail scanner or something in the iPad that caused it to do stupid things. And obviously, if it did, I'd like to fix it. But that's basically email. And again, the way this all got here is we defined our default gateway and resending, you know, SMTP holding directory, a directory where if we see files, they're supposed to be sent, where our mail authorization file was, so we can call it anything and put it anywhere. We might want to, for instance, put it out on a LAN so we can edit it while the system's up. The mail auth file, if you edit it while the system's up, the changes take instant effect. The next message will get your new criteria. So you can do it on a LAN and change it on the fly and instantly change the mail operations just by editing that file. And under SMTP, how often should it look to see if there's any messages to send that have been dumped in by a gateway or whatever? And how many maximum simultaneous attempts should it make to make outgoing mail calls to other systems to deliver mail in parallel? There are also a couple of commands options in your manual on here for things like timeout values for connecting to systems. Sometimes you might find yourself connecting to some slow system in Australia that's running in a kangaroo's belly somewhere that takes more than the minute or something to make an SMTP connection, and you can adjust those things. They are rarely needed. The defaults normally work well. And those would all be on the SMTP command in your manual. And there's a number of little things there that you can tweak if you have a special case where you need them. Now we get to the part that's really the router. And this is in the iPad, you define your hardware. To tell the iPad, what have you plugged into me and how have you hooked it up and what am I supposed to do with it? And what am I supposed to think of it? I'm going to start with the serial ports, because your asynchronous RS-232 serial ports are the ones which have the most different things you might think they are. You might plug them into a modem and want them to answer as a slip PPP line. You might want to write a script and hook it to one and have it dial out and connect to another system. You might want to not be a PPP slip TCP/IP line at all, but be a pure RS-232 line that you plugged into your phone switch command so you can telnet to your phone switch. You might want it to be a line you hook to a terminal server so that you can hook it to a dumb terminal and have something you can telnet and FTP out with. Basically, this is the only thing that rivals email for how many different things you're going to want to do with it. And if you got 16 lines, you're going to want 3 of them to be one thing and 4 of them to be another and 6 of them to be another and some odd combination. I've attempted to make this as simple as possible and still address an amazing variety of things, but this gets a little out of hand in places. It's the most out of hand part of the iPad configuration because you have the most odd things you want to do with one line here and there. While you're working it, remember in general that it is got lots of considerations, and most of what you can do with it, you probably in your setting, most of it you won't want to do. But you want to find the pieces that you do want to do out of the mess. The first thing is that while we supply the system with a digiboard, the software is written to be able to work with a number of other multiport cards. We don't support its operation with anything else, but the software does allow it. So that's why you have the multiport command that says, I have a certain kind of multiport card plugged in. Normally you're going to say type equals digiboard, what's its interrupt, and what's the address of its status register. This can handle bitmap registers, all kind of stuff. I'm not going to go into how to do that, but that's what this means, is you've defined that you're basically using DigiBoards. The ones you buy from us will always say this, because that's the way we always build them. Yes?
That's the maximum number of lines
in an iPad. Maximum number of lines an iPad can hold is 32. As far as RS-232 serial ports, 32. And we ship it that way with two 16-port DigiBoards. That's how we achieve 32 serial lines on it when we build them. Terminal server lines. Those are the lines that you might want to connect to a BBS or to a dumb terminal, or you might want to make them recipients of incoming telnet for any reason on earth you want. As I said, the phone switch thing's not an anomaly. We DataStorm, they did that. They had some phone switches, and they ran them around, and they put telnets on different ones and gave different phone switches different IP addresses so they could telnet them all and control them and check their stats remotely. On a terminal line, you have a lot of options. You start by giving it a name. All the interfaces in hardware in the iPad, the first thing after the definition is the name of the interface. You make that up. You can make it up to 30 characters long. I would suggest you make it under four or less in general. It's just easier to deal with. And it will display on our screen in all cases completely, because in a lot of places it'll be chopped to the first four letters if you make it longer for display purposes. Because it's a serial, you put in the port address, the IRQ, the speed if it's async, how fast is that line going. Buffer is there. You don't need to use it. It defaults to a 2K buffer for high-speed lines. You might want to make it bigger. And then you have a bunch of options. As a terminal server, and these options are purely 100% for use with interchange and TBBS. We had a number of customers who wanted to hook their TBBS up so the people could dial their BBS, reach over to the iPad, and then do PPP slip through the line they called the BBS on. So we have the option that you can say, yes, you can do slip and PPP through this terminal server line. What it means is at the CMD prompt, you would type PPP or slip, and it's going to flip over and become now, and you better have something on the other end that can deal with it, because that's where you are until you hang up. You never come back. And dynamic is a dynamic address to assign if they go into slip or PPP mode. So in essence, that's what you would define for terminals if you defined any. And that's what it's there for. Now this is the one you most commonly will want. This is how you configure an auto answer line that will do slip or PPP. You do PPP or slip, give it a name, port, IRQ, speed, buffer, and you say it's an auto answer line. When you have made auto answer lines, then you have to define a few extra parameters for your answer lines after you've defined the lines. And under the answer command, you can say all, and if you say all first, that becomes a default for anything you didn't say anything else about. Or you can put a specific port number here. Auth says, what's the authorization file for this answer line? Now, because of this, you can see, you can say all have one, and then I could put answer SL8 auth equals a different file and have a completely different authorization structure for that. So different people can call that line than can call this. They go through completely separate authorization files. Yes?
That overrides the all?
Yes. All becomes a default if it appears before any other things. So if you list all and then put the same command down for specific lines, the specific line will override the all. So all will fill in all the pieces you don't want. And that makes a lot of this easier than if you have to list every one, especially when you got 32 lines. Yes?
Would you do that if you had a person that had a dedicated dial-up account?
Absolutely. If you had somebody with a dedicated dial-up account, you if you're giving them a dedicated phone number, and a dedicated line, then you'd make their own authorization file that they're the only ones that can log in on that line.
And then if you were giving them one of your other lines, you'd take it out of the statement
up
above?
No. This is defining the hardware. Once you find your hardware as answer lines, you're now defining the conditions of the answering. Like I say, this RS-232 stuff is the only part of this I have not simplified as much as I want. I'm still struggling to find better ways on the configuration of this because it's just so much stuff that you have to want to do. And so many conditions that everybody wants it a little different here, and I want one like this, and I want one line to be different. Well, you just said it. First question I got is, well, what if I have one line that's different? Well, they're all auto-answer lines. It doesn't sound like this big, but I got one line that's different. Well, pretty soon, this starts to spread out, and the iPad will let you do all kinds of things with these lines, and the result is this gets a little bit odd. But the key is, answer lines are defined. The answer command fills in the parameters of an answer line. As a shorthand, if you say all, and then after it say the same thing with a specific line, all becomes in essence a default that you're only putting in the ones that are different after that. So if you've got one with like 15 lines that are one way and three that are different, you could put all and then specify the three that are different after it. On the DigiBoard ports, you must do them in order from the front. Otherwise, it won't work when you define them. Now, you don't have to make all your answer lines, and then all you can make them be whatever you want in any order, but you have to specify them in here in sequential port order, yes. You cannot skip a line on a DigiBoard port. And that's because of the hardware-efficient polling registers they have in them. You just can't do that. So you list the authorization file. Then you
part, which is the famous modem init strings. Always the fun parts of dealing with modems is the init strings. We do have a file we post on the support BBS that has several hundred modems. We've tested out and what the strings are. We try to keep current. But again, you put in an init string, this is done once when the iPad restarts and never again.
9822, area code 303. You can also just telnet to esoft.com, which is probably a far better way to go if you're on the internet than to play long distance phone charges. That's correct. Well, if you're an iPad owner, you're authorized.
What about the ICBM?
And ICBM, you're authorized if you buy ICBM. And if you get there and you're not, you call tech support and say, what did you do to me? I'm a customer and you don't know it. And they'll fix it. And be appropriately obsequious. I'm very sorry, esteemed customer. We shouldn't have done this to you. But this is just these init strings in quotes for the modems. The other thing that you need to define for, and these you have to do one line at a time, you can't do these with all, is you pick an IP address if you want to use dynamic addressing. What is the address that you will give out for dynamic addressing for an individual line? Right, for line number one, if you go dynamic, this is the address you'll give, and they just put them down. Every line you have that you want to let dynamic addressing happen on. And be sure that you reverse DNS all of these or your customers won't be reversed when they call in. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this one because the people who need to know probably already know. There's a thing you'll see in the manual about TIPX lines. This was to let you hook the iPad to our BBS software without 100 cables. This simulates an RS-232 line over IPX over an Ethernet between our BBS and the iPad, and it has no other purpose in life. And it just basically says, I can take $2,500 worth of serial ports and cables and turn it into two $100 Ethernet cards and a cable. So the people for whom they wanted it, they were real interested in it, but it's not a big deal for anybody who's not using it. Now I'm going to stop here before defining other interfaces, and I'm going to go to the authorization file for dial-up, because there are some real important things here that while they're all written down, they aren't always understood and heard. There are some things the iPad does extremely well that if you need to do them, they're difficult with most terminal servers. You'll see here, for instance, I can give a name and a password a specific IP address. But what that says is, I'm not using dynamic addressing. Doesn't matter what phone line this person calls in on, if he has this name and this password, he'll get this address. After this morning, you know there's a lot of routing considerations that come into play from that, and the iPad just does those for you automatically and undoes them when it hangs up. And multiple iPads gang together will do them across all the iPads automatically as well. And you don't have to do any configuration to make that happen. Yes?
We have potential lines that roll over. If we set a bunch of users like this with a static IP address, can they all have the same IP address?
No, they cannot, because you can't have two computers with the same address, and if they two of them call in at the same time, two different places would have the same address, and that's illegal. The second one in would be told that he couldn't be there. His route wouldn't be established. That's right. And your little red light would light up on your T1 line and you'd have to call the phone company to get it fixed. Actually, that's not what would happen. What would happen is the second person in would be told he couldn't be there in a cryptic way that he would never understand, so he'd call you to explain it and you wouldn't know either. But now you will. Question, and this is one of, and I don't want to do too many of these examples, but I want to do enough to get the point across, because this is a real important point of something the iPad does well and easily that other equipment doesn't do well at all. And there are some very real needs for it. The question was, if you have a user who has normally got a computer on the LAN with a particular address, and he's got a notebook and he's on the road, could you put him in dial-up with the same address so that when he was on the road on his notebook, he looked like he was still at his desk as far as the internet was concerned? Yes, you can, if. And the if is, if he doesn't dial in more than about 20 minutes after the last time he used his system at work. That's the ARP issue, because ARP will hold on to it. But what will happen is, when he dials in, this address will be routed in the iPad to him. And if the iPad is your gateway to the internet and the iPad is routing to your Ethernet, it will get the proper priorities and this will override the other one. If your gateway from the internet is to your LAN, however, from another router that's not the iPad, then he'll have to turn his computer off in the office, because otherwise what will happen is that router will ARP the Ethernet, the iPad will say I'm 210, his computer at his desk will say I'm 210, and we'll have a collision and nothing will work right. But if he powers off his computer before he goes out, then it'll work even in that setting. This is a real key part. You can route a subnet down the dial-up with the iPad. And the way you do it is you put slash and number of bits of the subnet mask, and the whole subnet will come into being routed down the phone line when he calls in. There's almost no other equipment out there that'll do that. And that comes up more and more frequently as people want to have a little LAN. They dial in, and they have three computers that they're in, and they want three addresses. They dial in, and you can give them a subnet. The key is, if you explicitly put in here an IP address or a subnet, it does not matter what line they call in on, that's always what they are. For most users, you will use the keyword dynamic here. The keyword dynamic here means when you call in, take that dynamic address we configured that matches that phone line and give it to them. So what phone line you call in on determines which address you got. Because if you give every user their own IP address, if you have 400 users, you have to use 400 IP addresses. If you use dynamic addressing and you have 32 phone lines, you use 32 addresses for 10,000 users. Because they only have an address while they're connected. And it's the address of the phone line they called. But for special cases, which come up, where you want people to have a fixed address, or more to the point, dial in and get a whole subnet, you put that in here. And the key is, after today, you should know enough to ask me, well, what about the routing that happens? That changes all the routing because that address gets routed down the different phone line. What if I call in on line 1 and I get this address and I hang up and I call back in on line 8 and get this address? Or you got 2 iPads and I call in on a phone line 1 on the first one, I hang up, I call in on phone line 7 of the second one. Now they even have to handle the Ethernet ARPing and everything about the routing has to change, right? And the iPads will deal with that. And they'll deal with it with no configuration specifically addressing it. It will just happen if you use this structure. A whole lot of the iPad is an attempt for me to be real hard once so you never have to know it was hard. That's an awful lot of what the point of the iPad is, quite frankly. There's also some other fields I'm not going to explain in there that are pretty straightforward, like maximum call times and inactivity timers. I mean, you're not going to be confused about what those are. What I'm trying to do is key you in on the parts of this that don't get easily understood.
So is that file that you just had, is that required on the iPad?
That file, we're going back here, I'll do it again. I know we're going through a lot of stuff awful fast here, and it's pretty easy to miss relationships. That file was this file.
Okay. Mine doesn't have that same name.
If you don't, it can have any name you want because you put it here and you make it up. The whole thing is, if you don't, we didn't freeze these names because you're not going to like my names, I'm sure of it. You want your names. This is your box. You should be able to name them what you want. The reason the whole file name is listed here is you can name the file anything you want, and you can put it anywhere you want on any drive you want.
It's another file you probably want on a separate server.
It's another file that if you put it on a separate server so you can edit it over the LAN, when you edit it, it takes immediate effect. Next call in works the way your edited file works. So that's the serial line stuff. I won't ask if there are any questions because we'd use the next 5 days on questions about serial lines because there's lots. The trick is you can do about anything you want to do with the serial line configuration in here. If you just kind of puzzle it out, it's not really as difficult as a lot of ramifications to make in little something that sounds real simple to express in a question can really have a whole lot of hidden assumptions under it that you got to work out. Ethernet interface, another common interface you put on here. All the interfaces to Ethernet, token ring, and synchronous cards are done through the packet command. What the packet command says is the interface is a real mode FTP software format, which is called a packet driver, has nothing to do with packets, packet radio, has nothing to do with anything. They just called it a packet driver. And I don't know why they called it, probably because it's IP packets that it's probably hooking up mostly, or Ethernet packets. It's created by a company called FTP Software, and it's a specification like ODI and NDIS and all those things. It's just a format for a driver interface. So you need a packet format driver for any device that's Ethernet or token ring, or for the specific devices and formats that we support on Synchronous, which right now is only a single card that we have. Again, the next thing right after, it's name of the interface. You make it what you want it to be. And with the packet drivers, they always interface with a particular software IRQ. They're normally in the range 60 to 70, I believe. And so basically, your packet command says IRQ 62. At startup, the iPad will query the packet driver, find out what kind of card it is, and work out all the appropriate encapsulations. If it's an Ethernet card, it'll Ethernet encapsulate it. If it's a synchronous card, it'll PPP encapsulate it. It'll work all the things and hook up all the software to match whatever kind of card it found. If it's token ring out there, it'll make token ring encapsulation. Packet driver, it finds that this interrupt tells it. That becomes an interface, and all your encapsulation is automatically determined by the kind of card it is. Now, ultimately, there'll be an addition to this when we start doing frame relay that you'll have to tell it. If it's a synchronous card, you'll have to put another keyword on it that says frame. Because normally it would use PPP, assuming it was a point-to-point, and you'd override that with frame relay. However, and if you just put this much down, you're done. And the iPad will work, and it will route, and it will do everything you want. And with Ethernet, that's frequently the case. However, if you know enough about routers to know that this is not enough to route with, you can put the rest of it in. You can give this port an address on its network. And a net mask. And that will now tell this that it belongs to this network and that it's a node on this network with its own identity. And it will create automatically a static route for this network. And know that everything in this network is supposed to be sent out this interface, and you've done routing it if you do that. If you hook up a leased line synchronous serial interface, you'll see that same thing. Packet, give it a name, give it the IRQ, and because it finds there a driver for our NIWAT synchronous cards that we've had designed for the iPad, it will know that it's a synchronous line, and it will encapsulate a PPP, and it will handle all the HDLC stuff automatically. On a synchronous line, you will always want to do this because your provider will require you to, because he's probably got a Cisco or something on the other end that'll get really upset if you don't become a node on his network. So he will give you normally this network address, 255.252, for the reasons we discussed this morning in routing. That's the normal subnet that's used on a leased line. Gives you the two endpoints addresses. That's your entire configuration for Ethernet, token ring, and synchronous lines. That's it. That's what you do. And you're done. Now, if you want to put in static routes, we've got some examples here of how you might want to do that. And generally, you will want to put one static route in. For most iPad installations, the iPad is kind of at the end of a leased line. And it has some local network considerations, maybe one class C or two or three class Cs, and everything else in the universe is usually out, either an Ethernet if it's got a router to it, or a synchronous port if it's going out the leased line. So you will normally want to say route default, and remember what default is, that's that zero with a net mask of zero that matches, if nothing else matches. Through equals says route it through that interface. And this says, route this class C network through the Ethernet interface. So since we just hooked up a static line, we would come up here to this, and we would change it to say, route our default through SS0 now. It goes out our leased line. Now, in some cases, when you're routing through Ethernet, you might have another gateway router out there. Remember the gateway considerations? And so you might be routing through an Ethernet to another router that has to go out on the Internet. It's not a common situation with iPads, but it can come up. If you do, you would put 2 = 199.45.143.14. That's the gateway. It says route it through this interface, and it has to go to this gateway. The /24 says it's a 24-bit NAS mask, which is the same as 255.255.255.0. You can specify net masks either way throughout the iPad. The slash notation works everywhere. That's how you do routing on the iPad. You're building these route tables. What have you got? Network address, net mask interface. That's a routing table entry. And you just stack up any you need. Yes? That's a user filter. we'll get, if I've got some time here, unfortunately, that's the part that's going to get most compressed here, is the filtering and security part of this, I'm afraid, from being a little bit late. But there's a situation, in a dial-up situation, in your user log, you can create an IP filter by name, and on a given user log ID, give that filter name and say, when you log in, this filter's applied to you. And what you would do is filter them to say that you simply will reject any packet with an internet address other than the local network and put that on the internet. So you can build your packet filter. And